week, and if for some reason I run out of time, which is very possible, we might go the next. But I promise not 8 months of Dead Sea Scrolls. Really, the main point of this is to take the mystery out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're used in so many strange ways, like, for example, in the very popular Da Vinci Code, as Jonathan talked about. They're used to show how Christianity is really defunct and Christianity is worthless or Christianity's fake or something like that. When if you actually go and read them and you look at them, you go, okay, whoever says that really doesn't know what they're talking about. But there's a lot of mystery surrounding them because nobody reads them. They're found in a cave. They're 2,000 years old. They're from before the dawn of Christianity. You know, there's just this big cloud of cool around it, you know. So I figured the best way to solve this problem would be to demystify. One thing we're going to be doing is we're actually going to be reading some scrolls. Probably not many large scrolls because we do not have 8 months. But I have one attachment there on the very end. That's the opening paragraph for a very important document. Then also there's another one on the third page, but we'll be getting to that. Imagine yourself as a first century Jew. Okay? You believe that you have a teacher. This teacher has taught you the way of truth. Okay? It's not all about, according to this teacher and according to your beliefs, it's not all about externalities. It's not all about just making sure you get the sacrifice done, that you obey the letter of the Mosaic Law. It's also about the heart. Okay? It's also about internal purity. God doesn't really care if you do the externals, but you're wicked on the inside. He cares if the inside is pure. You also believe that you are of a chosen generation. You are really the recipients of the new covenant. God is renewing in your midst his work with Israel because Israel has rejected the truth. Now the question is, who are you if you say this? You are certainly Christianity, because this is one of the foundational beliefs of early Christianity. It wasn't about the internals, it was about the internals. And they also did believe, as we believe, that we are the end time generation. We are those who are the recipients of the new covenant. But that was also the case for the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, there were some very significant differences, like, well, they didn't follow Christ, which we would, of course, consider a very significant difference, and also a number of other issues. But the thing is, this is a group that really, if you read their stuff, they're not all that weird, okay? When I used to think of Dead Sea Scrolls, I used to think these really esoteric, strange people living out in the wilderness. Well, no, they were Jews. They were, sure, they had some strange ideas, but they weren't completely off the wall. And there is a decent bit of overlap between some Christian ideas and some of their ideas, for the simple reason that all the Christians at the beginning and all the Essenes, or all the writers of the Qumran documents, were also Jewish. They were all reading the same writings, the Old Testament. And so there's quite a bit of overlap. And based on that overlap, some people have gone to the conclusion, like Dan Brown and others, to say, oh, well, this is just Christianity. Christianity wasn't founded on Christ. It was founded in some strange Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls documents or something. It's not like that at all. And if you actually read their stuff, you go, okay, they're actually normal people with a few strange ideas, but they're normal people. So let's get an introduction. Of course, everybody's familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? We've all heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm sure. Is there anybody who hasn't, just to embarrass you? Okay, everybody's heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is quite possibly the greatest archaeological find in modern history, certainly the greatest archaeological find last century. In 1948, there was a little shepherd boy, a Bedouin, who was hanging out, if you look at your map, there on page one, near Qumran. Okay, this is on the northwest side of the Dead Sea. He was with some of his goats. Goat apparently went into a cave, so he decided, how am I going to get a goat out of a cave? I'll throw a rock at it. So he throws a rock in the cave and he breaks something. He hits a piece of pottery. And so that's how they actually found the Dead Sea Scrolls. So isn't that interesting? The greatest archaeological find, certainly last century, possibly in the modern times at all, was found because some shepherd boy threw a rock in a cave. That's pretty cool. Well, so he found that cave that way, and the Bedouin, the other shepherds, found several other caves. Then archaeologists, whenever they found out what was actually going on, which was not immediately, they went and they found six more for a total of 11 caves. Now, these are all around the town called Qumran. Qumran there was founded in roughly 150 B.C. and was occupied at various times throughout that period up until the Roman invasion in around A.D. 70. Different groups were probably living there at different times, but it's one of these groups that people generally theorize collected and wrote some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, there's some important terms there on the first page. We'll skip that. Maybe we'll come back later. Look at the short history. We just talked about some of this. The scrolls themselves were written somewhere between the 2nd century B.C. and the 1st century A.D. Okay? That makes these really, really old. They don't know exactly when most of the scrolls were written. They didn't really often date things like it's January the 8th, 140 B.C. They didn't do that. So they can't really date most of them. But they know this is generally the time period from which they came. The community itself was wiped out around A.D. 70. So that's why we know it's definitely that old. Because nobody lived there after the Romans came and wiped them all out. Nobody lives there today except for archaeologists. The first scrolls were actually published in 1950. Now, what the Bedouin did when they found the scrolls, they're thinking, money, right? So they took some of the scrolls, they went and tried to sell them on the black market. That's how archaeologists came into contact with the scrolls, and they were like, okay, if there's stuff this old, we need to go find more. So finally, things were published in 1950. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if you've heard this before, but I have a book at home. Not my home, my parents' home. My brother bought it. It's a book called The Dead Sea Scrolls Deception. You ever heard of this book, by any chance? It's quite humorous in hindsight now. This was written before all the scrolls were published. As you see here in point six, there's a lot of the scrolls, about 40% of the scrolls, weren't even published until the 1990s. Because the people who were put in charge to edit, they were really lazy and kind of snobbish and didn't want all their knowledge in the public, I guess. But up until the 1990s, they weren't published. And so people started coming up with all sorts of conspiracy theories. Like the Vatican is trying to suppress these documents because if they come out, they're going to destroy Christianity. And that's exactly what that book says. That's what it's arguing, saying when these scrolls come out, Christianity is going to fall because this just exposes all the lies about early Christianity. Well, they finally got around to publishing them. And then, of course, all of those kind of arguments really start to sound like what they are, just kind of a farce, bad argumentation. But it's kind of funny. But they weren't all published actually until the 1990s. And they found total now about 900 scrolls, almost 900. Some of these include very small fragments that might have five words. Some of these include practically the whole book of Isaiah, very large scrolls. So it really just depends on what scroll you're actually looking at. Now, what's in the scrolls? A large amount of it is Old Testament. Okay? The Dead Sea Scrolls, not surprisingly, they were Jews, and they were very very concerned with the law. And so they passed on a lot of Old Testament text. So that was really the most important thing that they found here. The reason why is the oldest manuscripts that the Hebrew Old Testament is really based on up until this point come from about the 8th to 12th century A.D., which means that this one find took our Hebrew Old Testament back 1,000 years. That's pretty significant, right? That's 1,000 years. That's half of the period between Christ and now. This one find took it back. And in some cases, took us back and gives lots and lots of text with stuff like Isaiah. That's pretty significant. But that was a large part of what was in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You also have a large amount of non-canonical books. There's something called the pseudepigrapha. Pseudo meaning false, Epigrapha, grapha, meaning writing. Okay? False writings. These are writings falsely attributed to someone else. Like, for example, the book of 1st Enoch. Okay? We've heard of Enoch. Enoch was Genesis Enoch. Okay? Enoch, we're pretty sure, did not write 1st Enoch. Because 1st Enoch came about sometime roughly the 3rd century to the 1st century B.C. And so Enoch did not write 1st Enoch. But what they did, and this was very common in the old days, they would write a book, then put someone really smart or someone famous, put their name on it and say, this comes from Moses. This comes from Enoch. And so suddenly you get credibility there. And what they don't have there is they don't have the nightly news. So you can't, you know, you could pass out a document and say it's from Enoch. And you don't have people spreading around news all the time with false documents going around. It's very hard to verify this stuff. Okay? I mean, if you have a good critical head on your shoulders, you can go, okay, it makes no sense to say that this was passed on from Enoch. But if you don't, it's really easy to actually start thinking that some of this might be from Enoch. Well, you find stuff like that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Jews of the time read that material. They probably didn't consider it canonical. They would not have put 1st Enoch probably on the level of Genesis or Leviticus or Jeremiah. But they read it. There are even some evidence to say that the New Testament writers read it. But that would be no surprise. They were Jews too. They grew up in Palestine. Popular books in some cases. So you find some of this. And that's pretty interesting stuff. You also find community faith documents. And we're going to read some of that today. They have something called the rule of the community, where they talked about the oaths that they were going to have to give to be a part of the community, whatever that community was. Rules that they had to live by. Who were the people who were had oversight over the community, things like that. So they had community faith documents for whoever this was that was writing these scrolls. And they are also something very cool that you have some of the very first commentaries. They called them peshers. They were explanations. They were interpretations. Where they would say something like, going verse by verse through Nahum, here's a section of Nahum, then they'd say, explained, this means yada, yada, yada. Okay? And by and large, the purpose of the peshers, or the pesherim would be the proper plural there, these explanations is to say, here's what Nahum says. This is why we, and this is talking about us, and this is why we need to keep doing what we're doing. They would be writing these commentaries to say, hey, what we're doing is right, and B, what God promised in the prophets is being fulfilled in our time and in our community. So they were writing these commentaries to argue their position, to explain to themselves, saying, this is why we do what we do. Basically. Now, there is a great deal of argumentation about actually who wrote the scrolls. Most people will say it is the Qumran community, and they were Essenes, and they wrote those scrolls, and then whenever the Romans came and wiped them out, they left their scrolls in their caves and were never found. Some will actually say, and this is why it's relevant to what you say, that whenever Rome was about to sack Jerusalem, some of the leaders in Jerusalem took the scrolls, took them out there to hide them so they wouldn't get destroyed. And then, of course, were wiped out, and so they never went back and got their documents, which is very fortunate for us. There were probably more. That last view is a minority view, and I'm thinking more and more, even though I would prefer that to be true, just because that would tell us a whole lot more about regular Judaism. It's probably not true. And so what the documents were probably primarily for were for their own members, to encourage them to say, they're the bad guys outside, we're the good guys inside, and this is how God is fulfilling his promises to us. Though they probably sent some of them to the regular Jewish establishment just to feel good about themselves, probably. Their methods are different, but they're similar. Midrash being another way of taking Old Testament text and interpreting it and applying it. Different Jewish modes of doing interpretation. So those are the major things you find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Any questions about that? You don't find any New Testament documents. Okay? You don't find that. One person once argued that a small fragment of about 5 words came from Mark. Nobody listens to him. but you don't find any New Testament doctrine. It's all Old Testament. It's all Jewish. They never talk about Christianity as far as we know at all. Even though they actually could have. Christianity was around during the time of the Qumran community, if they're actually the ones who collected these. They could have talked about Christianity. Though they're off in the wilderness, they might not have really had much interaction with them at all. So, any questions? To the extent that they're Old Testament, yeah. I mean, they have some of the scrolls in the Shrine of the Book. So, yeah, they're very important to them in that sense. The other stuff, well, no. The commentaries, the extra-canonical works, they don't accept them any more now than they have always, or now probably even less. Well, they found that to the Masoretes, the 8th through 12th century scribes, they were incredibly accurate. Not much difference, generally, between those scrolls and the others. And so it was, from what I understand, I've never done any comparison myself, but partially because I'm rather weak at Hebrew. That they were very, very similar. And it was a good confirmation of what the textual history was of the Old Testament, at least between that thousand-year period. So, it's very encouraging. Old Testament students didn't suddenly need to get rid of their current Old Testaments and get something new. They could keep using it, which was neat. I think they're mostly for preservation, though. They found some things that weren't directly involved with the scrolls, but they would have scroll jars where you would have jars to put scrolls in for preservation's sake. But they never made it. Bummer for them. So they committed suicide. Anything else? The scrolls themselves were mostly written in Hebrew and Aramaic. Hebrew by that time was not the language of the average man. Aramaic was. Jesus probably knew some Hebrew, but would have definitely known Aramaic fluently. And the scrolls are mostly in those languages. There's a little bit of Greek in there, not much. Most of it's just Hebrew and Aramaic. Another random tidbit of information. Yeah. It's made of cow skin. It's made of cattle skin, goat skin, cow skin, something like that. I'm not sure what they use for the ink. So it's a great place for agriculture. If you're growing cacti, it might work. Probably so. I don't know. They were probably mineral based, I'm guessing. But I. That's something I don't know about. Could be it. Now, most of the scrolls were, almost all the scrolls, I think all but one scroll were actually made with vellum, which is, you know, the animal skin. They found one that was actually papyrus, which is more like a paper. And I think that was just discovered very recently, like in the last 2 years. Something out of First Enoch, as a matter of fact. But almost all of it is on vellum. And so it will last a very long time. Now, there was also some that were made on metal. There's the copper scroll. It was, well, obviously made of copper, but that, because it was so old, they couldn't unroll it, and so they actually had to cut it, just to, because it was rolled up, and so all the text was on the inside, because that's what you do with scrolls. You don't have the text on the outside, because it'll get wiped off. So they had to actually cut the copper scroll into pieces to take it apart, to read it, which is kind of unfortunate, but it's what you have to do, because you have a scroll that old, you don't just say, man, I wish we could read it, but, you know, it's closed and we can't do anything about it. No, you go ahead and say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and cut this priceless piece into pieces and actually be able to read it. And so they did. But most of it was vellum, parchment. Now, if you ever do any reading of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you're going to probably come across a very weird naming convention. It's the Dead Sea Scroll naming system, okay? I've since confirmed B with Reagan. We've had a very important discussion, colloquium, on this issue. But this is how you read this number. You have a number, then a Q, in most cases, and then another number. Okay, the first number is the cave. They found 11 caves, so they thought, hey, let's name them by their caves. So if they found it in cave 4, like this one, it's 4. K Q. Okay? Q, probably, this is our expert, professional, learned opinion, Q is probably Qumran. That's our opinion. And then the number is just a number they gave it. You know, name it 1 to 600 or whatever was the largest number of scrolls. K4 was actually the best cave. It had more scrolls than any other cave. It was also largely K4 that wasn't finally published until the 1990s. I think I read 40% of the scrolls were in that one cave. Anyway, so if you read it, that's when they say these numbers, they're not trying to be cryptic. It's just if you have 900 scrolls, you need a convenient way to refer to all of them. And if you give them all long names, nobody's ever going to be able to find their way around the documents. Okay? Now, they started giving longer names to them, but unless they're a really important scroll, they don't refer to them with the longer name. They'll refer to them with this particular numbering scheme. Okay? Like the Rule of the Community is a very important document. It has a number. It's 1QS. Okay? It's so cool it doesn't have that last number. But when people refer to that, they'll often say Rule of the Community because it's so important and everybody knows what that is if you read the literature. So that's how the naming system works. If you ever do any reading, you see that, oh, they're talking about a particular scroll. Now, if you do ever decide to do some reading in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can get English editions. That's great. You do not have to learn Hebrew and Aramaic to read them. I meant to bring 2 books with me. I just failed to do so. One by last name Gaster, I believe. Another one by Geza Vermes. Dead Sea Scrolls and English kind of stuff. You can get them probably down at Borders and Barnes & Nobles. Very easy to get. They're nice. I've used them sometimes. You can also get, if you want to learn Hebrew and Aramaic, you can get the Hebrew Aramaic left and then the English translation on the right. I know that's really high on all of your lists. So Christmas, come talk to me. I'll show you what book to get. Because I'm sure you're all aching to do that. We're already on page 3. Let's do a little reading. Now, what we're not going to talk about yet, just because I don't want to talk about the really interesting stuff so you can tune me out next week, okay? We haven't really talked about what we have there on next week. Who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls? The controversy about the Essenes. More examples, and then what kind of things are people saying about the relationship between Dead Sea Scrolls and Christianity. So I'm saving that for next week. Okay? So you have to keep listening if you're interested at all. But this time, we're now going to actually read some Dead Sea Scrolls. You will now have read more Dead Sea Scrolls than 99.8% of the U.S. population. Okay? So you should be proud of yourself. First one we have on page 3 here. No, I did not check the spelling after I typed this in. So if there are any mistakes, then I'm sorry. If there are not, then you can just go ahead and say, Eric, you have amazing typing skills. You don't have to, though. This is 4Q525, which means 4th cave. It was found in Qumran, and it happened to be numbered 525. The longer name is 4Q Beatitudes. Okay? Whoever wrote this decided to write some blessed be statements. Thought you might find this interesting since Jesus did something very similar, as we all know. The scroll starts with, lacking text. So that's where you see the dot, dot, dot. When you read these scrolls, you see a lot of this. Dot, 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 he said, dot, 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 house, and then that's all that's in the scroll, So that's very common with this kind of literature. But that's what's going on there. So with a pure heart and does not slander with his tongue. Blessed are those who adhere to her laws and do not adhere to perverted paths. Blessed are those who search for her with pure hands and do not pursue her with a treacherous heart. We're talking about wisdom here, as we see in the next one. Blessed is the man who attains wisdom and walks in the law of the Most High and directs his heart to her ways and is constrained by her discipline and always takes pleasure in her punishments and does not forsake her in the hardship of his wrongs, and in the time of anguish does not abandon her, and does not forget her in the days of terror, and in the distress of his soul does not loathe her. It's way too long of a sentence. For he always thinks of her, and in his distress he meditates on her, and in all his life he thinks of her, and places her in front of his eyes, in order not to walk on paths of something. Nobody knows. So there you go. That's some of the stuff that the Dead Sea Scrolls community wrote. Essenes, whoever, Pharisees, Sadducees. See, now aren't you glad you've now read more Dead Sea Scrolls than most everybody else in the world? I think there were a few more pages to that. I just didn't feel like typing it all out. They don't do the versification system. At least now they don't. One of the confusing things I found when I was doing some of my research while I was in school was at one point they switched reference systems. And so in some of the older works, I'd be looking up something and going, you said this is here, it's not there. You know, you're lying or you're ignorant. But what it was is they switched reference systems at some point and they forgot to tell me, which is very unfortunate. Now, like the edition that I'm using, that just refers things by columns. Because what you'll have is you'll have a scroll that's, you know, let's say yay long, and they'll do everything in columns. And so they'll refer to it by column and by line. Like you'll see here in this one, I just copied this directly out of one of my editions. It has column, COL1, and this is just column 1 of this particular document. This is the opening paragraph of the Rule of the Community. And then you'll have numbers. They're not verse numbers because they're placed in really weird places that you wouldn't put verses. They're line numbers. So when they broke a line, they'd start a new number. Okay? This is the Rule of the Community. This is how they define themselves, how they live their life. For the instructor, for his life, book, the Rule of the Community, in order to seek God with all one's heart, with all one's soul, in order to do what is good and just in his presence, as he commanded by the hand of Moses, and by the hand of all his servants, the prophets, in order to love everything which he selects, and to hate everything which he rejects, in order to keep oneself at a distance from all evil, and to become attached to all good works, in order to do truth and justice and uprightness on earth, and not to walk any more in the stubbornness of a guilty heart, and lecherize performing every evil. And so you can see, first of all, that they were very law-centric. Okay? Well, according to them, that was the administration that God had put over them. God had given them the law. And so, well, they were going to try to follow it. So that was actually what the community was about, following the law very strictly, with the heart, not just with externals. So you can sort of see what they're coming at here, where they're coming from. In order to welcome all those who freely volunteer to carry out God's decrees into the covenant of kindness, in order to be united in the counsel of God and walk in perfection in his sight, complying with all revealed things concerning the regulated times of their stipulation. So you see here their idea of their own community. They're to be kind, especially to those who are of their group, right? Because, as opposed to the others, they were the ones who God was blessing. They were the ones whom God was giving the covenant. Okay? They were the true Israel, according to them. In order to love all the sons of light, each one according to his lot in God's plan, and to detest all the sons of darkness, each one in accordance with his guilt, in God's vindication. All those who submit freely to his truth will convey all their knowledge, their energies, and their riches to the community of God in order to refine their knowledge in the truth of God's decrees and marshal their energies in accordance with his perfect paths and all their riches in accordance with his just counsel. They shall not stray from any one of all God's orders concerning their appointed times. They shall not advance their appointed times, nor shall they retard any one of their feasts. They shall not veer from his reliable precepts in order to go either to the right or to the left. And all those who enter in the rule of the community shall establish a covenant before God in order to carry out all that he commanded, in order not to stray from following him out of any fear, dread, or testing that might occur during the dominion of Belial. When they enter the covenant, the priest and the Levite shall bless the God of victories in all the works of his faithfulness, and all those who enter the covenant shall repeat after them, Amen, Amen. So you're seeing where they're coming from here, right? By and large, these were just zealous Jews. They weren't weirdos out in the wilderness. They were zealous Jews trying to obey the law, thinking that the current establishment, which we would agree with, was corrupt. Okay? They were corrupt. They controlled the temple. We separate out into our own community. We share everything in common. We don't own wealth. We give it all to the community. And we come together and we follow the priests and Levites and try to follow God.
They had their own priests and
Apparently so. Now, this also comes to the issue of who were they? Were they Essenes? The Essenes, I don't know whether or not they actually had their own priests and Levites, but the Essenes were commonly having communities outside of major cities, like Qumran. You could say that. And I bet you they didn't use electricity. Pretty sure. So I don't really know. I can't answer that. Can you answer that?
No, I was just going to say, we also have to, try not to dichotomize there that the two options of either their Essene community or its mainline Judaism in Jerusalem, hiding the scrolls, as though if that theory gets disproven, that by default, oh, it was the Essene. Certainly possible third option.
It's a different group altogether.
I don't know who it is. If you disprove it, somebody we do know about and hadn't thought of it.
One of the important advances in the last 60 or 70 years, I guess, and primarily in New Testament scholarship, has been the idea that when they start reading stuff like this, they go, there was no Judaism. There was Judaisms. It wasn't one huge Judaism that believed one thing. It was a group of different belief systems that they were all very similar. They all followed the Old Testament to a certain degree, but they weren't exactly the same. In the New Testament, we don't have any records of Essenes, but you get them in Josephus and you get them in Philo, both right around that time period. But there's certainly room, as Reagan mentioned, this is just a different group. This could be one community where neither Essene nor Pharisee nor Sadducee, they left Jerusalem and as a group went and lived there. The Essenes were, page one, important terms. Essenes, let's start there. A Jewish sect, like Pharisees and Sadducees, who are believed by most to have authored the collection of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That doesn't say much there. So, there you go. That's how you spell it, at least. There you go. Characteristics of the Essenes. A group of Jewish people who followed the same basic ideas. They were, by and large, celibate. So the Essenes were, by and large, just men. They didn't even invite women into their communities in general, I don't think. There were a few instances where some Essene communities were actually allowing men to marry. But mostly they were celibate Jews who were following the law. Secondly, sometimes they live in cities, but lots of times they like to live out in the country so they can separate from the evil folk. Very law-abiding, very concerned with ritual purity. They took lots of baths, ritual baths, to make sure they were clean. Every time before that they would go eat, they'd be out working in the morning in the fields. They would come in, they would take a bath, and then they could eat. Supposedly very well respected by the people of the time because they saw them as very humble, very zealous people. You can find large descriptions of them in Josephus and Philo. If I remember, I'll try to bring some of that next week, just for you to see them. They're not as well known just because they're not mentioned in the New Testament like the Pharisees and Sadducees, but Jesus apparently didn't have any significant encounters, at least none that were actually mentioned. They are unlike the Sadducees, and they do actually believe in the immortality of the soul. Some of them even believe in the resurrection, from what I hear. That's apart from the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. Just one of the ancient writers was saying that they did actually believe in the resurrection, unlike the Sadducees. And so, they were probably a group that was looked on by the general populace as generally very admirable, but from the Jewish leadership, especially the Sadducees, who were higher up, more upper echelon kind of Jews, probably looked on with great suspicion and great dislike because they were constantly critiquing the Jewish leadership.
You can actually see the caves, but they're very you have to be a mountain climber to get up to them.
Pure children's skeletons, the Qumran as well, skeletal remains, but women and children are a significant minority
in terms of skeletal remains, and their lodgings are apparently segregated. I said there was not a cohabitation between men and women, but nonetheless, the men seem to be, the children seem to be in a hysteria. And, of course, there are no women in the liturgical order of the community.
One of the things that complicates it, and this is just a piece of information that just doesn't help us nail anything down. I was at Society of Biblical Literature two weekends ago. I talked to one guy about this a little bit. He said, and he teaches at the University of Jerusalem or something like that, said that there were actually 11 different strata in Qumran,
yeah,
some of which were not Essene. And so one of the problems with actually doing digs in Qumran is you might be digging and go, oh, well, this shows they're not Essenes. Well, what time period were they actually from? Because different communities actually lived there at different times. And this goes into the whole issue of who was actually there. Were they really Essenes? Some people have argued to say, well, they have lots of community baths. They have lots of ritual baths there for you to take ritual bathings. Well, some people say, well, that's actually very common everywhere. And so that really doesn't mean that they're even Essene at all. Some people say, okay, well, they found jewelry. Well, okay, if it's jewelry, that probably means they're not Essene because they're not going to keep that stuff. But what time period were you actually digging in? And it's not something that's easily accessible for us to be reading. So you kind of have to go on a lot of this on hearsay. This guy says this, this guy says this. I don't know, and I have no way of testing, so I'm just going to say I don't know. That's often the best way to do it, just to say, were they Essenes? Maybe. Regardless, they're interesting. And I think I'm just personally coming to the conclusion that they're way too anti-Jerusalem, way too anti-establishment to be from the establishment. So I don't know who they are, but I know that they're not them. And it still gives me good insight into one piece of Judaism, at least.
Expand on how this affects how this affects us.
No, it's next week.
Oh, okay, another question. You mentioned in passing evidence that the New Testament writers may have had access to or read the especially the bigger book.
There's one case that is probably the most important. This would be in Jude. Jude either quotes from 1st Enoch or is referencing an event that 1st Enoch also references. Does that make sense? So either 1st Enoch is writing about something he heard, whoever wrote 1st Enoch, or whoever's, because it might have been written by multiple people. There's this event. Had to do with angel. I think it was the angels rebuking Satan, right?
Arguing
over the body of Moses. That's from 1st Enoch, or from a common tradition as 1st Enoch. And so, whenever you read stuff like this, and this gets into next week, which I'm not going to talk about, does give you relevance for understanding what was going on in the New Testament authors' minds. What was their background? What were they thinking? Because, you know, they came to the table with a lot of assumptions that you just don't have. Because they read a lot of stuff you have not read. And neither have I. Some of which does not probably exist. So it helps us get an idea of what's going on in the back of their head. Or like something else from 1st Enoch, Reagan's thesis. We found something when we were reading where we saw that, Jerusalem was referenced as the city on seven hills. Okay? Well, what is known as the city on seven hills? Well, that's normally associated with Rome. Well, 1st Enoch calls it Jerusalem. Okay? Now, when we talk about Revelation, if you want to talk about historically, what was the writer of Revelation thinking of when he said the city on seven hills? What are Jewish people most likely to think when they hear seven hills? They think Rome, which is far away, or they think Jerusalem, which is already in their literature. That's pretty significant for New Testament interpretation, but not till next week. I've got to gotta make sure you show up next week, you know. Because I'm just still really bad about myself if nobody comes. I'll just be depressed and have to read the Dead Sea Scrolls for myself.
Presenter, Do you have a feel for a literacy rate at that time, the common Jew? Did they read or write Aramaic? Or was
probably
it always
not.
The Pharisees of the time that would read? And
the Jews at the time were probably more literate than most anybody else, just because they did have their holy writings that they needed to read. But by and large, it was done by reading in the front of the synagogue, like Jesus did in Luke, where he went, he took the scroll of Isaiah and read it and then interpreted it. That was generally how people had access to the Torah. They did not have their own copies because scrolls were so incredibly expensive. No mass production. You actually have to copy down manually everything you want if you want it. So, but by and large, they were probably more literate than the average Gentile, but I don't think they would all be literate, not like America or something like that.
If your parents allowed you and you were allowed to go to Hebrew school and synagogue,
then you'd be very literate.
Yeah, but if you were a half-breed, you wouldn't be allowed to do that, or if you were not Jew at all, most likely you'd be illiterate.
You'd probably know how to read basic Greek, like from inscriptions. Or maybe some basic Aramaic from inscriptions?
Well, these documents are probably handled by a select group of academics.
I would imagine. Let's assume for the sake of argument that it was the Qumran community who actually produced this. I bet you every single one of those were literate, because that was their business, reading and following those. And so those cases, probably every one of the people at Qumran, if they produced it, would be literate. Because that's what they did. That's what they lived for. The average student now. You know, those who went to Hebrew school or wanted to be a Pharisee professionally or something like that, they would obviously know how to read.
I just correction on Jude, the passage you were referring to about Michael contending with the devil in the body of Moses in verse 9, actually assumed to probably be from other books.
Oh, Assumption of Moses.
It's in verse 14 that he actually explicitly refers to. He said, Enoch also sent him out and prophesied of these, saying, and then he quotes a little passage out in 14.
There you go. Thank you.
There are two weird things in it.
The first passage we read is extensive use of the pronoun, feminine pronoun, her.
That's referring to wisdom. Like in Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. And so they just continued that and just say the her is wisdom. You made me think about something else and now I forgot it. So, oh well, so much for that. I'll think about it for next week. What's our time like? Are we completely out of time at this point? Okay. Well, we're going to officially dismiss at this point, but questions are still on. No evidence that anybody would generally take credibly.
There's a rent center in the parking lot that has a lights on.
Is this a prophecy from the Dead Sea Scrolls?